Master of Physics.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me here. So yeah, that's a different title from what I gave for the program. It's a bit broader, but I should be a little bit modest at least, and so I'll put some applications of neural network and cognitive metaphysics. So last night I was preparing this talk, and I thought maybe it's nice to look how much of the new machine learning has started to go into cognitive metaphysics, and this is the number of cognitive meta papers with machine learning in the abstract in the recent years. And so you see that this doesn't really follow the general trend of machine learning. We really picked up this topic relatively late in the community, but now over the last two or three years, it's been broadly sort of anticipated that this might be something useful, even though with some skepticism by a lot of colleagues. And so following up on what Una has presented, I want to give you an overview over a few applications of machine learning technology in cognitive matter that I've been working on. So my talk will consist of three parts, but the second one is really the biggest, will take the biggest amount of time. First, I'll present some face classification applications, which are rather straightforward applications of neural networks. And then in the second part, I'll talk about neural networks as variational wave functions for solving quantum many-body problems. And in the last part, I'll just give you a sneak peek at what we could try to do with quantum machine learning now that some quantum architectures are becoming experimentally available. So this work is largely the work of my students. Kenny Cho has been working in particular on the second part very intensely, and Frank Schindler mostly on the first part. And in particular, the second part is, of course, in tight collaboration with Giuseppe. And then there's a lot of other collaborators on various sub-projects. Okay, so face classification. Why is that something I bring up here? Well, it's largely because cognitive metaphysics at the heart is actually a classification problem, right? Because we want to understand phases of matter. We want to tell apart a phase of matter by universal property. So like, topological phases, superconductors, crystalline phases, and so forth. So in that sense, neural networks seem to present themselves as a natural tool to work on this problem, even though we've just recently started to use this tool. And so just as one example, a little bit along the lines of what Una has presented, here is where we use neural networks in its most simple, straightforward application to really classify phases of matter. Namely, we wanted to classify crystal structures by their space groups, and the data that you can use for that are scattering data. So in this case, we looked at powder samples, powder XRD diffraction data, and we wanted to see whether plain vanilla neural network can tell you which space group this is. So this is what plain vanilla means. So these XRD patterns, they look if you look with a naked eye, they look like just like some spiky line, and it's hard to tell apart anything about universal information about the crystal structure if you are taking an uninformed look at these things. And so there are 230 space groups for non-magnetic materials, so you would like to classify these kind of patterns into 230 different categories. So here's a neural network that does this, and now the problem is you don't actually, and that's really a lesson I think that we've learned over the last, taking these first steps in this direction, is that in general in these cognitive matter setups, there is a lack of data. So we are actually not really having big data in many cases. So if you try to find these XRD patterns in a relatively standardized fashion, there's actually barely any database that has a sufficient number for doing such training or classification tasks. So what we did is actually we theoretically simulated them for all compounds that are reported in the material database, and then trained the network with these theoretically simulated patterns. And then sort of this is the results for crystal systems, which are just 7 categories or space groups, so you have 230 categories. And we use 2 different networks, a convolutional and dense one. Turns out the more straightforward dense neural network does a better job. But sort of these, when I say test set here, this is theoretical data. So for instance, the crystal system you get with 73% accuracy, the space groups with 57% accuracy over these 230 space groups on the theoretical data. But of course, the important test is the experimental data. There's one data set that's available. It's called RUF, which is, maybe the name is actually quite telling. It's a rough, it's very rough data. So some naturally occurring crystals, just geological data, essentially. So these are really imperfect, not very good crystals that have been investigated there. And we find a 54% accuracy. So 54%, more than half of the time, at least, we can pin down, the network pins down out of these 230 space groups the right one. That's maybe not super encouraging, but still not, you know, far away from a random guess, obviously. And also we can see the wrong ones are not completely off. They are just like off by you know, very little. There's space groups that differ very little in symmetry. And then what we can do, however, if we allow the network to also say that it's uncertain about a decision, and sort of say, okay, if you don't know, then tell us you don't know. There's also a piece of information. Then we can easily put this up to, for instance, 80%. So that's, of course, if you know that your data is not perfect and that you might not be able to tell even the answer from just that data, then that should be an allowed thing to do. Okay, so that's for the experimentalists. But of course, we are theorists, and the amount of data that we have, or that I usually have on my computer is mostly numerically obtained data for model systems, and we would still often like to know in which phase are these models that we study, right, in a certain parameter regime, and here is a typical setup. So oftentimes we know the phase of these models or the phase which our data is represented by our data very well in some extreme limits of a phase diagram. But then in the middle, we don't know where exactly to put the phase boundary, right? So we don't know, for instance, some phenomena in physics, we might not know what the order parameter is or so. And then you know, this might be a setup where slightly more unsupervised approach of phase classification might be useful. So I'll now talk about one specific example of such a case where we can train a neural network with data deep inside the phase, and then we ask the neural network, where would you put the phase boundary? And the toy problem that I want to use for that is the problem of many-body localization. So it turns out that this problem has now become somehow some sort of standard candle for trying out a neural network performance. For phase classification, there are at least a handful of papers on exactly that same problem. And the setup is the following. So we are looking at the spin chain, which consists of spin 1/2, and then they're coupled with this Heisenberg coupling. But in addition, we put a random field on every side. And unlike in most of the cases when we think about strongly correlated quantum systems, we are not only interested in the ground state, but we are interested in the behavior of a generic eigenstate of this system. And there are 2 regimes, basically, that are interesting. If this disorder is very small, so this is the width, this h bar is the width of the disorder distribution, then this is a thermalizing system, so the quantum system itself obeys the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So if you look at a subsystem at high energies, the subsystem density matrix looks thermal, obeys the standard rules. You know, you would derive the standard rules of statistical physics from this. However, if this disorder field is very strong, then you enter a regime that's called many-body localized. And in this case, what you basically see is that you pin the degrees of freedom to some local fields. And these interacting terms cannot destroy this picture, essentially. And what you find in this case is that the system retains a memory of its initial state, even an initial state that has overlapped with high energy states if you time evolve it for arbitrarily long times. So there's no thermalization going on. Okay, so we can obtain data for such state, for such systems with exact diagonalization. So we basically have the full ground state for small system sizes. But it's of course still not trivial to tell these two phases apart, right? So that's what we want to use the neural network for. So the quantity, or the, so we could compute any correlation function. Obviously, we have the full ground state. But the quantity that's usually looked at is the entanglement spectrum. And what that is you take you take any eigenstate psi, build the pure density matrix, and trace over a subsystem, trace out the degrees of freedom in some subsystem B. And then you have the reduced density matrix, rho A. And the spectrum of rho A is what's called the entanglement spectrum, or the logarithm of that. So this entanglement spectrum is now like an entanglement fingerprint of the quantum state, and it can tell apart whether we are in this very localized regime or whether we are in a thermalizing regime. However, it's not so easy to access this information from this entanglement spectrum. So, so various measures have been sort of studied for this numerically, and one is just the, you know, this so-called Schmidt gap, which is the difference between the first and the second eigenvalue of this entanglement spectrum. But you can also look at the scaling of the entanglement entropy, which is then the trace of rho log rho, with the subsystem size. Then you would see, for instance, in this localized regime, since all the physics is local, it doesn't scale with the length, while in the thermalizing regime it does scale with the length of the subsystem. You can look at the standard deviation of this entanglement entropy over consecutive eigenstates in a small energy window and then say something about the states in this energy window. Or you look at the level statistics of these the entanglement spectrum. So these are all some sort of statistical measures, but they, you know, they all have their drawbacks. For these level statistics, for instance, you need rather large systems to have a statistically significant statement that you can make. You need to do finite size scaling, or there are various problems with all of these approaches. They require a lot of data on large systems. So we thought let's just ignore that we have any knowledge about the physics going on, and just apply a plain vanilla neural network to this problem. So we put in this entanglement spectrum, a lot of numbers, and we want to have a classification between ETH and MBL, eigenstate thermalizing or many-body localized. So that was supposed to be the network's task. So there's nothing really complicated in this network, two layers and some standard activation functions. And then maybe the only non-trivial thing that we do here is in the cost function that we define. So of course, the cost function, usually you have the cross entropy, and another aspect is, or another popular thing to put there is weight decay, so that the neural network only uses as much of its degrees of freedom as it absolutely needs. But then what we do as well is, so the scenario is that we want to train this neural network on the data on the very left and very right of the phase diagram. So in the extreme cases of completely localized and completely thermalizing. And however, later we want to apply the resulting neural network to the states in the middle where we don't know where the phase boundary is. And so what we do now is to get a good answer later to where the phase boundary is, we force the network to be very opinionated, if you wish, about all the data that it's going to see later. We don't say you should classify the data in the middle as 0 or 1, but we say that you should be sure about it. So what we do with this term in the cost function is we show the network a few data sets from the middle for which we don't have a label, but we say that whatever label you predict for it should be close to 0 or 1, okay? So that enforces a sharp phase boundary later. Okay, and yeah, weight decay I already discussed. So this is the result. On the left is a phase diagram that's been obtained with all these other methods that I told you about. And on the right, we have the phase diagram that's obtained from our from the output of our neural network. So we trained on with data on the left and with data on the right. This this is the energy density, and the horizontal axis is the strength of this disorder parameter. So the red region is the many-body localized, and the blue region is the thermalizing region, and you see this phase boundary here. Okay, so what has to be said is, first of all, there is a quantitative agreement between these two phase diagrams, but also this phase diagram here has been obtained with way, way less data than this one. Yeah? So we have fewer disorder realizations, and we also used a smaller system size to obtain this phase diagram. And that's one thing, yeah? Okay, so that's maybe I should have scaled it a little bit differently. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing deep about it. It's just a matter of okay, it's not scaled to the same.
Just wondering if they will still look so similar if you just.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, the question. I mean, so okay, there is more. I didn't scale it to look more similar than without it. We have also quantitative comparison that I'm not going to show here. Yeah?
I have a question. So on the left phase diagram, I can see exactly in the phase boundary there's error bars.
Yeah.
What are the error bars in your model? Mm. How can it be your network?
Okay. So the question is, how do you assign even an error bar? Yeah? That's not a trivial thing to do. It gives you a probability, but the question is even so you have so many errors, right? You have the number of disorder realizations, and you have to ask, you know, how do you even, I mean, where do you put the classifier? Do you put it at 0.5 or I mean, there's a lot of arbitrariness in this, right? This is going to be a point of criticism for them. So we thought hard how to put error bars, and we decided that there was no meaningful way of doing that even. But I mean, this is a good point. Also, you could ask, why is it so washed out? Well, that's coming because there are different disorder realizations already. So what I want to now say is that with very little data, we can, however, get a very sharp phase transition for an individual disorder realization. The question is, how meaningful is it? First of all, with respect to robustness, we also changed, the type of input data just to make sure that there's no bias in the way we set up the network. So we changed, for instance, between entanglement spectrum and the differences in the entanglement spectrum. We used different cost functions and so forth, and made sure that there's no substantial shift in this depending on the cost function. But now, suppose we want to find a classification for a single disorder realization, a single instance of this model, then one of the best measures that is physically informed would be the standard deviation over a sequence of a subsequent number of states of this entanglement entropy. And this is what this would give for you, this kind of phase diagram. If we feed the same data in our neural network, we get a way sharper phase boundary. Of course, the obvious question is, how meaningful is this physically, this very sharp phase boundary? What is clear is that the neural network gives you a way sharper information with very with fewer information or with fewer input. Okay, so that's what we learned there, the main message. And then, of course, you know, as physicists, we'd like to know, what has the network learned, or can we infer some new physics from this? And one thing that's useful for this is this dreaming technique, where you cannot only make these very absurd-looking images, but you can also do, you know, once you have a physically trained network, you can also get some new data. So the way this works is that you have your fully trained network, and you give some random input, and now you change the input you change the input and optimize for one of the outputs. So for instance, I want to optimize for ETH, And then I can, you know, change the input until my ETH label gives you exactly one. Yeah. And so we did that a bunch of times with some random input. Well, actually, the input was an undecided. It was an entanglement spectrum. The network didn't know whether it's MBL or ETH. So it's one of these blue ones. And here I give the entanglement spectrum, so this sequence of eigenvalues. And so then it turned it into either ETH or MBL, being the red ones. And so what we see here, these are the dreamed entanglement spectra. These are raw, like sort of real data. What you see is that these dreamed entanglement spectra, in the MBL regime, you find a very clear power law feature. Yeah, and this is actually something that's been sort of discovered shortly before us. Using different techniques, obviously, by studying MBL with the insights of a physicist. But sort of if we had not known this result, this would have been maybe a hint, yeah, that the neural network discovered to look into this direction and maybe, you know, see whether this is a physically relevant effect, that there is this power law. In any case, what we see is that the dreaming really brings about reasonable entanglement spectra, so the neural network hasn't learned something arbitrary. Yeah. Okay, so let me summarize this part one, where we talk about phase classification. We see it works. It gives you, you know, with a relatively plain vanilla neural network, a good classification result. The only non-trivial ingredient we actually used is this confidence optimization, so saying that the network should make confident decisions about the data that we have not labeled. And now, obviously, there are some problems. One is the quantitative correctness, even estimating the error, as you were pointing out. Also, it would be harder to discover new phases, but you could imagine other approaches easily to circumvent that. And of course, the interpretability of the result, which we try to address, for instance, with this streaming. But the advantages are also important to mention. So for one, this is very simple and performant. So we do not need to do scaling analysis. We do not need to do a lot of statistics and so on. And we have not, so it's definitely, to obtain this phase diagram is definitely way easier than the other one. And we do not need any physical insight about the phase. So this is maybe also why this application has been so popular, because MBL is not fully understood, and it's not clear whether actually there is a sharp phase transition or whether there is some crossover and so forth. So what the actual physical quantity to look at is not so clear. So it's a good application for an unbiased technique. Okay, so much for part one. Now let's go on and do, you know, forget about phase classification. And let's see whether we can use neural networks as computational tools, really. And the idea here goes back to a very important work by our organizer here, Giuseppe, together with Matthias Treuer. They put forward this proposal to use a neural network as a variational wave function. So in goes, for instance, the position of particles or the orientation of spins, and out comes a complex number, which is your wave function. Yeah, that's, and so the neural network itself embodies a quantum state. And so, of course, this is not the first time somebody proposes a variational wave function. There's a long history of quantum state compression in condensed matter or numerical condensed matter physics. There are matrix product states. There are a lot of variational tensor network states and so forth. And so the question is, why do we need another one? Well, for instance, one thing that's important to note is that these type of neural network states are able to capture long-range entangled phases of matter, which are very much to the interest of the community, so which are, you know, for instance, chiral P-wave superconductors, fractional quantum Hall states, and so on, those with topological order, which are harder to capture with matrix product state type calculations or tensor network calculations. Okay, so that's the motivation. Now, what we want to really do is we want to get this machinery working as a tool that we can apply to arbitrary systems. And so let me just show you two problems that we worked on to get towards this goal. So one is that oftentimes the Hamiltonians have specific symmetries like translational symmetry, rotational symmetries, and we would like to get not only the ground state of the Hamiltonian, but we would like to get eigenstates of a specific symmetry. So that's obviously something that's important to use this tool. So we want to get eigenstates of symmetry operators as well as the Hamiltonian. And of course, we would not only like to know what is the ground state and the ground state energy, but we would also like to have excited states, access to excited states, for instance, to answer the important question of, is there a gap in the spectrum or not? Or are there degeneracies which are, for instance, topological in nature? So if we kind of can sort of make these things work, we could really start to get a tool that is somehow complementary and competing with, for instance, exact diagonization or DMRG calculations for generic problems. So what kind of networks do we use to represent quantum states? I don't know why I write all these random Boltzmann machines. Of course, a restricted Boltzmann machine. just to make you laugh, obviously. So one popular architecture is this kind of restricted Boltzmann machine, probably because it has this nice interpretation at first sight where, you know, you have, so this is written for a spin chain with all the spins being the sigmas, and then you have, so these are the spins of the system, and then you can introduce these hidden spins which interact with the visible ones through this weight matrix, Wij, and then you have these bias fields, which are little magnetic fields, if you wish. So there's a nice physical interpretation of this. However, it directly breaks down the moment we use complex weights and biases, which we have to do in general, right? So in any case, you can sum over those hidden spins, and then you basically have this kind of neural network where you have a log-Koch activation function. And then, so your data, your input data are these sigma i's. Yeah, there's some bias. We can also generalize this to incorporate feed-forward neural networks. Also, we can make it deep. So, for instance, here we would have something that looks very similar, but now instead of just summing with equal weight all these coefficients, we would give them a different weight each, and then we have more generic looking feed forward neural network. I'll quickly tell you how we, for instance, cope with the symmetry problem. This is actually not so trivial because you have a linear operator in general to act on these labels on the data, like on the spins. For instance, if you have a translational symmetry, you know, you would relate your spin configuration with the spin configuration moved over by one lattice side. But then to implement this on the level of the neural network, since the neural network has non-linear activation functions, you can't just push through essentially this kind of linear transformation onto the degrees of freedom in the next layer, if you wish. So what we do instead is that we force the neural network to have this transformation property according to an eigenstate of translation symmetry, so an eigenstate of the momentum operator, by enforcing the property that if I look at the translated spin configuration, I get the same output as before, plus ik, plus the momentum eigenvalue I'm targeting. Yeah, so we basically sort of do the optimization subject to this constraint. Okay, so what do we get then? So here is a simple sort of benchmark example. This is a 1D chain, Heisenberg chain, spin 1/2. And what you see here is the dispersion of this. So this is a gapless system. It's the dispersion, so the lowest energy state as a function of k. And you see that this works. And what you also see, I contrast here the RBM and the feed-forward neural network result according to the two ansatz that I showed before, and you see that this feed-forward neural network is actually doing quite a bit better, especially in these more excited region of the face diagram, where probably states are much closer to one another. Yeah, well, not face diagram, but excited in this region where the states are higher in energy. Okay, so typical errors, so this is compared against the exact data, so for 36 sites. Typical errors are in the order of 10 to the minus 4. That's the relative error on the energies of these states, okay? And we can also do this on a different system. Here's a Bose-Hubbard chain. And so this is basically just, you know, hopping and Hubbard on-site interaction. And what you see is, again, it works rather well. The problem is here we are running out of competing methods that could give us information how well we are doing. For instance, here's for 40 sites with 40 bosons, and you see that we're doing fine with the first two states, which we compare to MPS, but actually for the higher states, we don't have a comparison. So that's, you know, that's what we can, however, easily compute. Yeah. Okay. Now, the other thing that I mentioned is we would like to get to excited states. How do we do that? Well, of course, once we have a ground state, we can just make our optimization scheme such that whatever state it proposes is orthogonal to the ground state, right? So that's a straightforward thing to ask for. The only thing that you have to, you know, try to do is to make sure that it also is numerically precisely doable. And so we tried that as well. Here is again this Heisenberg antiferromagnet, and this is now not using this translational symmetry. So what you see is that this is the gap between the ground state and first excited state that we find, and this gap goes nicely down with the system size. And if you plot over 1 over L, then you see it goes exactly to 0 in the thermodynamic limit, what you'd expect. Okay, good. Now, I'm always interested in how these things perform as well in terms of, you know, computation time or however you can measure the scaling and performance of these algorithms. But it's a bit hard yet to say anything definite because it's even hard to compare the variational technique, for instance, with DMRG or with ED. But so obviously, I mean, one thing that's obvious to say is that we can very quickly reach systems where ED is not a way to go anymore. So here is, for instance, just a comparison of computation time. ED obviously scales exponentially, and here the computational time is for this RBM method is you know, certainly some power law scaling. What exactly, I don't want to commit to. Okay, but now these are sort of toy benchmark problems. Of course, we want to work towards problems where there are open questions, yeah? And one of them is this J1, J2 model on the square lattice in 2D, which this is more recent data. Some of this came out of Kenny's computer yesterday. So here's the model. And the key thing about it is, so you have this nearest neighbor interaction between the spin 1/2 degrees of freedom and the next nearest neighbor. And you see that this is frustrated in general because at small J2, you want to make a staggered antiferromagnet, you know, so that the nearest neighbor bonds are happy. While at large J2, you want to have this kind of striped phase with a zero pi order parameter. And of course, in the middle, we don't really know what happens. This is a problem that's been extensively studied by various techniques. And it's been suggested that especially here in the middle, there might be an interesting spin-liquid phase. So that's sort of one of the challenge problems that we picked for ourselves. Now, it's a little bit like with this Go players, right? So you remember that in many stages, you know, Google trying to beat the best world's best Go player. So this was the first guy that had to let his title go, his second Dan. Then maybe half a year later, they beat some 9-star guy, and then finally in May 2017, they were world champion. These guys never look very happy, but they still earned like $300,000 or so. And so for us, we now have this J1, J2 challenge, and trying to beat all these people. I'm glad that this, I hope, so you get this joke. Okay, that's great, because, you know, There was this other machine learning workshop where we had the classification between Reese Witherspoon and, I don't know, another actor, and nobody knew any of those actors, the physics audience, you never know. Okay, so here's Federico, sitting right here, and is, for instance, been working on this problem with variational Monte Carlo. So what we are now trying to do is use neural network architecture as a variational wave function that is a little bit more advanced than what I talked about before. So it's now a convolutional neural network. So this is our convolutional filter that we sweep over over the spin lattice, and we have, you know, six layers of with various number of filters, 12, 10, 8, blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, we do average pooling and get our, and this is all complex numbers, right? And we get our complex wave function number out. So this network that I'm describing here can be used for all system sizes, has about 3,000 parameters. And here is how it performs. I'm just showing you a very small region of the phase diagram from J2 equal to 0.4 to 0.55, because that's the critical one. And so this is for a 10 by 10 lattice. And I compare to, well, one comparison is to this guy. This star here is another reference that uses a neural network. They have 10,000 parameters, so three times more. And the energy that we obtain is this black line, zero. Yeah. So they're way off. I don't know. So it tells you that you have to do it right. Yeah? You can also easily write down and optimize a wave function and not so well. Okay, if you zoom in a little bit, then you see that both VMC and DMRG are worse than we are in this regime of J2 smaller than 0.45, let's say. But they do better in the regime 0.5. And then if I would plot this further, my hope would be that we are getting better again for large J2, but I don't plot it further. Okay, so anyway, so what we see is that the neural networks are certainly competitive with leading techniques, and depending on where we are in phase space, worse or better. Here are also, we can plot, for instance, the order parameter, and here this is for smaller systems so that we compare to ED, and you see that it matches well in these extreme regimes, and in the middle, we're kind of a little bit off, yeah? Okay, so that's where we are in our challenge, in our J1, J2 challenge, but of course, we keep working on it. Just to put this a little bit in a broader perspective, so for this 10 by 10 lattice, right, if you were to store this wave function with ED, you would have, if you have 1 terabyte hard disk, you would have 1 light year large stack of hard disk. I just thought this fun to mention. Of course, it's easy to impress with exponentials. DMRG, for the studies that I showed, use about 1 million parameters, or order of, I'm not exactly sure. The variational Monte Carlo has very few parameters, of course, and has this sort of physics-inspired ansatz. Our neural network has about 3,000 parameters. If we talk about biases in the ansatz, of course, we don't really know what would be the bias in the neural network yet, maybe. In ED, it's, of course, unbiased. There's no, except for the finite size, there's no error. And DMRG has this entanglement bias that you kind of not so good at capturing volume law entangled states, right? So one has to contrast all these pros and cons, and I think there is a good point for using these neural network variational states as, you know, one player in this game to figure out complex many-body systems. Okay, so that's in the interest of time. I'm not going to reread this summary, but I have a very quick sneak peek at quantum machine learning. I just want to mention it because it's something that's not been mentioned so far. The question or the idea here is that instead of neural networks the way we talked about them now, we use a network of quantum gates to do machine learning type of applications. The fundamental difference is, of course, that all these quantum gates are unitary operations. Yeah, I cannot sort of make this information go in this kind of bottleneck way. So the way I introduce a nonlinearity is by just looking at part of the output I measure, collapse the wave function, or part of the wave function, right? Okay, so this is a field that's been popular already for a few years, and I'm not showing you any contribution to the theory of it. For instance, if you want to look at some contributions from participants here, there's Miles Sudenmeyer that has several papers. And the idea here is to capitalize on our condensed matter intuition about matrix product states or tensor network states more broadly, and use this to build architectures for such quantum machine learning applications. I just want to show you a simple example because now we start to be able to use actual quantum simulators like the IBM quantum computer to test out such things. Here's a simple example that we can test on these. So what we do is we prepare quantum states in these. So here's a 4-qubit system, and each quantum state is prepared in this, as a real superposition of cosine and sine. So depending on what the input data is, the qubit will be sort of more on the north pole or on the south pole. And then we have 3 unitaries. Each of them are composed of 2 C0 gates and a bunch of rotations. So there are 6 free parameters in each of these unitaries. So in total, there are 18 parameters in such a network. And then we measure this 1 qubit. Okay. And the problem that we want to study here is this so-called balance problem, where you have a scale or a balance configuration with 2 arm distances, 2 weights. And the question is, does this, given the 2 weights and the 2 distances, does the scale tip to the left or the right? So that's the classification problem we want to solve. And so we trained this on a classical computer, get an accuracy on the test set of 95% for some data set that we created. And then we put this on the IBM Quantum 20 Tokyo machine. And what was surprising to me is that we got a result on this machine of 94%. So this thing does almost as good as our simulation without noise and without gate errors. So what this indicates is that even though this computer is really not great, it decoheres and so forth, it basically doesn't introduce any extra errors. And I think the reason is that, all these neural network classification tasks, so they are intrinsically probabilistic. So these extra errors are kind of glanced over and the stuff still works. Okay, good. So now it's time for summary. And I'll just, quickly say that, there have been phase classification applications, which are sort of plain vanilla, if you wish, neural network applications. Then we want to use neural networks as variational wave functions with some partial success and a lot of work ahead. And finally, there is this whole field of quantum machine learning, I think, where the expertise and the intuition of quantum matter strongly correlated people is probably very valuable. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Titus. We have a question.
So back to the variational wave function in your contest.
Yeah.
Do you know why your neural network wave function performed? Do you know why there is a J2 dependence that plot? Right?
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a little bit hard to say why that really is the case, but it certainly has to do. It has to do with the updates. So this is a Monte Carlo algorithm that runs to optimize the wave function, and we basically know that there's basically the way you can set up the Hamiltonian. There's basically no sign problem, obviously, for large J and small J, and you're running into it right in the middle, the hardest, and that's, I think, my intuition. That's why this struggles in the middle at the most. Another intuition could be that it's an entanglement problem because there is a critical regime, but I would say that's maybe less, my hope would be that that's less of the actual reason. Yeah.
But it's possible the unknown bias of this class of wave function could be playing the role. Which
yeah, sure, know. Sure, yeah, of course, we can't exclude it. Yeah.
So, I have a question for you. Hi, so for part one, you mentioned you showed that Van Gogh, you were talking about dreaming. Mm. Are you saying that you use transfer learning? That's the kind of picture that you see for
so,
that subject.
Sorry, say that again?
Did you use transfer learning in part one?
I'm not sure. I know what that
there, is. There was a section where you're, I'm not sure if I misunderstood the slide, but you were talking about dreaming,
yeah,
and that was
yeah.
right after showing that Van Gogh picture, and that's, you know, like in one case, and then you transfer the Van Gogh style to a different picture, and that's commonly done for transfer learning.
Yeah, no, that's not exactly what we are doing. We are, our input is, it's not completely random. The input is an entanglement spectrum that the system is undecided. So it's like in the middle between MBL and ETH, and then we can push it to one side or to the other side simply by optimizing the parameters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about part one. So mm-hmm. you were making a point that you don't need finite size scaling for mm-hmm. this method, which is nice. But still, like if you try the method and you train it on two different sizes, I mean, does the phase boundary you obtain is compatible mm-hmm. between these two things? Is it maybe sharper if you do on large size? I mean, I'm still
so it's definitely sharper on large size. So we did some finite size scaling and didn't find a substantial. There was no substantial shift of the phase boundary with the different system size. However, I think one should take that with a grain of salt because the type of this 16 sites is like the largest. Or 80 maybe that we studied at all. And it's known in this MBL problem, in this specific problem, there's a huge finite size effect. So I wouldn't sort of, from these two or three system sizes, I wouldn't want to say that's where we end in the thermodynamic limit. I think it's fair to say that we pin down some sort of phase transition for that system size there. And for the system size we study, we don't see a huge drift. But as you said also, it spreads much more for this smaller system, so it would be also hard to pick up a trend. So it's a phase diagram for that system size, I'd say, yeah.
Sorry. For the second part, can you distinguish between like a singlet and triplet excitations in the formula?
So we didn't do that. Yet, but in principle, one can take that as a quantum number and but we didn't capitalize on the SU2 symmetry. Yep.
I have two questions about the second part. So the first one is, I assume because you trained a convolutional network, you used some of the standard loss optimizers. Which loss optimizer did you use there? And the second question is, you're using a convolutional network, so most likely your network is trying to learn the symmetries of the physical symmetries that you talked about sometime during the talk, for example, translation symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Did you actually check how well it learned the translation symmetry?
Okay, so that's a good question. It's actually pointing towards not really a problem. We solved it, but if you want to get rid of the sign problem at J2, for instance, you take a gauge that's breaking the C4 symmetry of this problem in the the state that you learn has actually then also not that symmetry, even though the problem has it. I mean, it's just a gauge choice, if you wish. So what we do to overcome this is that we enforce C4 symmetry explicitly, for instance, on this state, and so then it obviously also doesn't break it, there is a challenge there that if you don't really enforce these symmetries, you might, run out of them. That's a high-level way of enforcing them. You basically say, okay, I take the wave function and then the C4 rotated version of that wave function, and that whole thing, I take it as a wave function. Yeah. Oh, the optimizer. What's the optimizer we're using? Yeah, maybe you could.
Hi, so for your NBL thermal phase diagram, there is a pretty wide white regime, like near the transition, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if that's just pure finite size effect, or do you think there, have you guys checked whether it's maybe because of Griffith physics, gray region?
I don't think it's because of, I mean, the Griffiths, you would see it for a single sample as well, right?
Yeah.
And the single sample phase boundaries, that's what I showed later here, is very sharp. So the reason why this is blurred is really because of statistics. So if we would have more, you know what I mean? It's a superposition of curves like this. But because of the statistical nature of the, you know, you throw a field configuration, so this line lies a little bit somewhere else for each sample, and then when you average, you get something that's wider. This is the this is plotting the uncertainty. So this in the other plot, this would be red, this would be blue, and a very sharp transition for a single realization. So I'm not sure whether I would interpret that as a Griffith's phase. Yeah, it's more a statistical problem of the samples that we
use. The reason why I'm asking is because we expect Griffith effect
there. Yeah.
So is it not like sensitive? Can this method like see the Griffith effect, or is it not sensitive to that?
So I'd say maybe we are sort of killing this a little bit because we do this confidence optimization. So we say that we want the confident classification, and that means that it pushes the phase boundary to be very sharp. Yeah, and that kind of, you know, pushes your that counts your Griffith's phase probably into the thermalizing phase automatically. So you kind of don't really allow the network to explore that. Right.
I have a question about the dreaming thing. Mm-hmm. So when you, so if I understood correctly, you have this data set, yeah, right? And then you train your model, and then at the end you pick entanglement spectrum that is in the middle, so it, you cannot classify it, and then you optimize the output, right?
Exactly. So you change the input until, you know, you get out. So you get here maybe with this initially, you get 0.5, and then you tweak it until it gets you.
Right. Okay, so and then the question I have is, so your input data, it lives in like certain like region in the all possible input states that you can have,
yeah,
and when you optimize the output, you may get something that is completely like far away from this initial input state where your mm-hmm. data lives.
Sure. So, yes. Yeah.
So how can you guarantee that whatever you see is physically okay? Like, did you?
What it tells you, so the whole idea of the exercise is not to say something about the input. So ideally, this doesn't at all depend on the input, the initial input, yeah? It's not like this Van Gogh image. Maybe this was like a little bit not the greatest thing to put as a, it's confusing. But we want to say what has the network learned is a typical ETH and what is a typical MBL entanglement spectrum, not,
right,
you know, what is the nucleation of this dreaming.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that when you do this optimization problem, you may end up like in an input state that is arbitrarily far away from the data, because this optimization is not constrained at all, right?
So yes, sure. I mean, but then that would be an indication maybe that your network is, you know, it's been learning stuff that's not supposed to.
No, but it doesn't have to be about what it learns, right? Like, because you may optimize this function and it may be one very far away from the input data set. That's a possibility.
Uh-huh. Oh, right? Okay. So more, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you guarantee that what you optimize is kind of like within reasonable boundaries?
No, I don't think you can guarantee that. I'd say that's absolutely, I mean, no. So for instance, what we have to also tell, maybe I didn't mention that, but for a physical a spectrum, this should be ordered, yeah? The values should be ordered. That's how we always presented it to the network. But we actually have to impose this condition in the dreaming to get sort of this sensible ordering. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't be really unphysical, but it would be a different format than the other data that we had. So in that sense, the network would produce something that's not a reasonable input. Yeah? So that was actually the one condition that we put in this dreaming, that it's a decreasing set of numbers. Yeah. So yeah. But that was the only thing we put, and then we got something that looks reasonable. Of course, there are some correlations between all of these. So for instance, this kink here, that is kind of, there's certainly nothing physical about this kink, but it's there in all the dream data. So there's a little bit of a clustering. Yeah.
More questions?
About the J1, J2 model, mm-hmm. Do your network learn the Marshall sign rule, or you put them into your network, and how much the Marshall sign rule is violated in the frustration, when the frustration occurs?
So we put it in by hand. I mean, we basically on the, that's what I was trying to say. So we put it in on the left or on the right. And then, in the middle, we get the sort of not best result, yeah? So we basically, what we do is basically we allow the network to be, we allow the quantum state to be in a superposition of the of one where the Marshall sign rule is obeyed on the left and one where it's obeyed on the right. And it's kind of automatically adjusting at a given point in parameter space how much it likes to take the left or the right wave function. But that's kind of not this is not what we put in. Okay. Yeah. So that's how we do it.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
Let me clarify that you can learn the Marshall sign rule even without putting it, at least in the Eisenberg point. We've shown that.
Okay, thank you. Just for this phase space classification, where you have the broadening, and you introduced this extra term in the Voss function,
mm-hmm.
but can you comment on what the results were like when you didn't introduce this term?
They were not quantitatively different. It was mostly a broader distribution. Unfortunately, I don't have the slide here. Let me see, maybe I do. No, I threw it away. I think. Wonderful. Where was it? Because I skipped it. Okay. Without confidence optimization. Here, this so you want to look at these two. Actually, there is a little bit of a shift, though. That's what you see, yeah. It's broadening and it's shifting as well a little bit, yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we checked, however. I mean, this is, so what we did check is against the other methods whether there's quantitative agreement. And this is. For instance, with the level statistics where it's available, the quantitative agreement of this phase boundary is much better than this one. So it's if we want to take these other methods as a bias for where we should land, then we should do this. Yeah.
More questions, comments? All right, so if not, let's thank Titus again. So we now have a break, and we will reconvene in half an hour.